All right, welcome back to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm your host, Yogi Raw. Thanks for tuning in, subscribing, rating, and reviewing on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Overcast, and many more platforms. It's been an absolute blast, and we are knee-deep, it feels like, in the football season. We've only gotten through week one, but like we did last week with Thomas Williams, former linebacker at USC, as well as 5 years in the National Football League, we're going to try to tie in a little bit of football into a unique story. And this week's is really cool. It's a guy named Peter Abraham, and he is as gifted of a storyteller as I've ever been around. His tie-in is that he finished school up at UCLA. He studied film, storytelling, cinema. He's really gifted as a marketer. He's worked with some huge, huge brands. We're talking Lululemon, Nike, ESPN, Whole Foods. He's a guy who rebranded the Los Angeles Marathon from the stadium, which is Dodger Stadium, to the sea a couple years ago. And for me, he's been a great mentor. When I listened back to his story, so much influenced me, and I think you're really going to enjoy this one. He's a special guy with a very unique path, a love of travel. He's lived all over the globe, and he's really gone for it and played big. And this podcast is about exploring what it means to be human. Well, this guy, he defines what it means to be human in terms of going for it, letting it rip, and truly following his passion. I think you're going to enjoy it. I'm going to be calling UCLA this weekend against UNLV at the Rose Bowl, 5 o'clock on the Pac-12 Network. So there's your tie-in for a little football. But I think you're going to really get inspired and learn a lot about the marketing, advertising world, and really the art of storytelling all across the globe from one of my favorite people and fellow surfers, Peter Abraham, as this podcast occurs literally right after we got out of the water. Enjoy. All right, welcome back. Life Without Limits podcast. I am Yogi Roth, fired up for today. We've been doing a bunch of these podcasts, and like I've said many times, it has become it's become one of the coolest things that I've ever done. I look through life through the lens of a podcast, and today I'm staring across for the first time. This is another milestone, I think, on the Life Without Limits podcast, is that it's in my kitchen, and we actually have mic stands, and we are taking this thing to another level, and I'm inviting in and thankfully we have him in, Peter Abraham. So Peter, thanks for coming in, man. Fired up to have you.
Thanks for having me, Yogi.
Yeah.
It's a privilege.
Thank you. So Peter, we're going to dive into your story to give people a little baseline. Marketing guru, content guru, you've been doing this for 20, 30 years, telling stories in unique ways. And for me, you've been this mentor, friend, shepherd, alchemistic type of guy. And to set the stage for everyone, Peter and I, we go surfing, once a month or so, coffee, we have an SIE bowl here in Venice Beach, and we always have this epic conversation. So the idea was, instead of having the convo outside of Cow's End, let's have it via this podcast. So that's where we are this morning, Peter, and I couldn't be more jacked to have it.
Fantastic. I'm so happy to be here.
Okay, so I want to, I'd love to know what your thoughts are on the first time that we met, because I have a very clear, vivid thought about that experience and that engagement.
Yeah, I remember that. So I had been referred to, I was at the LA Marathon. I was the head of marketing there. And somebody had suggested that we do a partnership with Pete Carroll, which I thought was a great idea. He was at the time the coach of the USC Trojans football team. And I got referred to Brian Center, who ran one of his foundations. And I had a phone call with him. He's like, Peter, you got to talk to Yogi Roth. So somehow he connected us, and I think we met for lunch at Broadway Deli in Santa Monica. Is that right?
Exactly right.
And of course we clicked immediately. And, you know, I kind of find at my age and level experience, I have pattern recognition and I have a highly attuned radar for people. And so I can tell, honestly, in 5 minutes, if I like somebody and want to be friends or do projects with them, I can tell really quickly. And yeah. It was that case with you, obviously.
Yeah, you know, I was probably 24 at the time, and I get this call, hey, you got to go meet this guy, and the juice that came out of you, the energy was like Pete, you know, like it was infectious. I'm like, man, who is this dude? Hold on. He does movies, he's done documentaries, he's filmed things, he's been on camera. I was like, I want to be around this guy. I kind of want his life. And from that moment on, I mean, that's now 10 years ago, so we're still connected. So, I always like to start with that, of just where these relationships begin, because they take all these turns and ebbs and flows, and we'll get into the marathon and the creative about that. But to kick it off with maybe a difficult question, I want to know how you describe yourself, because I think I could describe you with so many different words, but you live all these experiences. You know, you just did a TED Talk. It'll be on the blog when we post this thing. But how do you do that?
You know, I don't think you can describe me in one way because I do a lot of things, as you said. And on one hand, I do a lot of marketing. The problem is what's happened with marketing now is that you can't separate the marketing from the product. So a lot of what I do is, whereas a brand, so professionally, right? My point of view is if I step back is, I help purpose-driven organizations and I'm also an entrepreneur. So I have my own purpose-driven organization. My point of view on life, you know, professionally with a lot of it is I like to use sports and technology to affect positive change in the community. How that kind of, you know, filters down to what I do. A lot of times it starts as a marketing engagement with a brand. I do a lot of work with Lululemon, for instance. But what it ends up turning into is helping brands kind of transition into the digital era. How you do business, everything has changed, right? So in the past 10 or 15 years, we've transitioned from the industrial age to the information age formally. And a lot of brands that were built, you know, pre-2005 still see themselves in the in the industrial age. And so, you know, what starts as marketing ends up being, let me help you guys get into the modern era, I think.
How do you think people view you when you walk into a room? Or are you
aware
of
it? Well, that's a good question. You know, I'm not necessarily that aware of it. I mean, I certainly have a certain kind of energy and enthusiasm that I think resonates with some people. Some people might hate it. I don't know. But, you know, to be honest, as I've gotten older, I try and worry less about what people think of me, which has been a challenge for me to kind of get to that point because I'm traditionally kind of thin skinned. And I think I was always somebody who I probably cared too much about what people thought of me. And so that's been a kind of one of my own, you know, a growth area for me is to like not really care and be myself and be happy with that.
When did you think of yourself as a storyteller and dive back? I mean, you just did this amazing TED talk where you had to dive back into your life and explore all your past, I'm sure, milestones and heartaches. When did that click and how did that get started? Because at your core, I would describe you as a storyteller.
Yeah, I am a storyteller. And I think I was born with that to some extent. I mean, I think of even growing up, I always thought about an experience as to how I was going to describe it to somebody. Like that's just how I thought in my head. And then in college, I discovered filmmaking and storytelling. And I came to UCLA because I had to be near Hollywood and then, you know, went into the film business. And I think I've always been a storyteller probably since I was born. And I think I always will be a storyteller and that will always be an important component of my life personally and professionally.
So where did you grow up and were you that way as a kid? Were you the guy piecing together, you know, whether it was art or whether it was video, you know, literal film back in the day?
Yeah. You know, my dad is a mathematician, is a math professor. So we lived in my early days where he was teaching, which was like Columbia and Princeton. 60s arrived. We moved to Berkeley in 68. We were right there for the riots in People's Park. Like I was there with him. He looks like Jerry Garcia, still does. He'd be wearing his American flag shirt. We have some pictures of me holding his hand in People's Park during those era.
How old are you?
I was like 5 years old. 69, we moved to Santa Cruz, lived in a commune in Santa Cruz in the second oldest house in Santa Cruz, an old Victorian mansion. We had like Timothy Leary was hanging out there. And I mean, I went to see the Rolling Stones, you know, when I was that age and the Grateful Dead and crazy stuff. And we lived in London and Paris also when I was younger, where he would do teaching gigs there. And then for my mom, it was like, you know, the 60s were kind of a fun phase, but she wanted to kind of raise her kids in a more kind of traditional environment. So they got a divorce and we moved with our mom to San Diego, North County of San Diego. She got remarried to a guy who was much younger than her. He was a great guy. My stepdad, I'm still very, very close to him. And we went back and forth. So we'd go like every other weekend. We would fly up to see our dad and go skiing. That's what we did with our dad. And then, you know, the rest of the time we were in North County, rural San Diego with our mom and our stepdad and my younger brother and I. And so I think in a way I grew up with two dads, right? Which there are great things about that. And there are also things like, I think part of my like why I have always tried to please people. So I had two dads who were different, who were both fantastic people. I'm still very close to them, but like I had two dads, right? And you're kind of, as a kid, you're trying to kind of please your dad. I think that's one of the things you do, and but you have two of them. So you kind of, on the other hand, I've always been comfortable. I can kind of have a conversation with anybody at any level in a lot of languages. I've always been good at languages. And I think part of that was because I had to communicate with two, I had to have one foot in two different environments the whole time growing up. And I became very comfortable in different environments.
What do you think, looking back on it, influenced you from being in Berkeley and being in that era? Because it wasn't like it was just a blip on the radar screen. I mean, this is an era that changed the country, changed the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, we look back now with psychology, you know, prior to you, we had Dr. Michael Gervais on talking about the influence of parenting. And I'm curious what you thought of your dad and the commune and that whole community shaped you, because you are a free spirit, at least in my opinion.
Yeah. I am a free spirit. And I think, you know, when I was really living in that, I was like 5, 6, 7 years old. I was very young, and I don't really remember that much of it. So it's hard for me to draw a very clear line to where I am now. But I think clearly, I think what you said, like, I am a free spirit. I think I'm really open to all kinds of different ideas and philosophies. And I think, you know, like, right after my parents got a divorce, 1970, my dad took off to India. He had a sabbatical year, and he took off for 6 or 8 months and lived in a cave in northern India, studied with a guru, and studied Eastern philosophy, trekked around Annapurna in Nepal. And then in 1991, when I was 27, I went on that journey. I went to India for a month and went into Kashmir trekking and some really crazy places, Ladakh in northern India, way deep in northern India in the Himalayas. And I went to kind of follow in my dad's footsteps in a way. I went by myself.
What do you think that is? I mean, you talked about wanting to please your pops. You see it in professional world all the time. Like, dad was a lawyer, son's a lawyer. Dad's a coach, son's a coach. How did that influence you? Because you had two different dads, one clearly an explorer. I haven't touched on the other one yet in terms of his personality. But what do you think that is? Especially because you weren't living with him full time.
Right. You know, I think that relationship impacts you in ways that you understand and in many ways you don't understand. And I remember I went to maybe in my late 20s with my brother, and I went to a big like men's group therapy retreat weekend that was all about how you are as a function of your relationship with your father. Mm. And I think, you know, there are a lot of complex things. Like, I think, you know, in a Freudian sense, I think you are trying to please him. In other ways, you're trying to get away from him and be your own person. And I think there are conflicting and oppositional forces. I think it's a complex relationship. I would say I don't fully understand it. But, you know, I think there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. What's your first memory of exploring? You know, is it exploring the commune? Is it that trip in India, Nepal?
No, I think, you know, exploring has always been super important to me. And I think for me, it was with our dad, we grew up skiing. And so my brother and I were out in the wilderness a lot growing up. Like, we would miss weeks of school every year. We skied competitively. We would go to camps in Canada and Mammoth in the summer to train. And so being out in the wilderness and in the mountains was always, like, since I could walk, was a really important part of my life. And I think informed a lot of my life and gave me a love for the outdoors. And my brother also, that I'll carry with me my whole life. And so that, I think that's where it started.
Wow. That's fascinating. I mean, you are a guy that I think is so connected to the outdoors. You know, you always, I'm imagining being a runner.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you're a guy, as you just referenced, always skiing. How critical is it to being exposed to elements that are outside of our control now? I mean, you've got two amazing kids and you're seeing them grow up in high school on their way to college in the digital age, where you were one that clearly didn't have that growing up.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a very different world growing up now. And I have myself, as you know, embraced social media. I love it. I use it every day. At the same time, I've also worked hard with my kids to get them outdoors, particularly when they were younger. You know, I took my son backpacking when he was 5 years old, took my daughter camping. I think when you get a kid outdoors when they're young, I think it's like giving them a gift that they'll take with them their whole life. Again, in ways they may not understand right away. You know, my daughter my son is like, he's a wilderness firefighter already in high school. He's completely into the outdoors. He sailed for years. My daughter's not like, her idea of the outdoors is going to Coachella. Right. But I think she will always have a certain appreciation of the outdoors because of the time we spent in Yosemite and places we've gone.
When did you first lean in? You were like, all right, I'm going to get into marketing. I'm going to get into the creative as a job. And so you go to college, right? You go to UC Davis, then you come down to Los Angeles to UCLA.
Yeah.
And are you thinking I'm going to be a filmmaker? Are you thinking I'm going to do marketing? Are you thinking I'm going to go skiing around the world the rest of my life?
Yeah, I totally wanted to be a film producer. That was my thing, like in college. And that's why I transferred to UCLA and I took a lot of the film classes. I did not get accepted to the film school at UCLA. It's super competitive. My grades weren't that great. But it didn't matter. I could still take 70% of the classes in the film school, which I did. And then I was ambitious about it. I started doing internships in the summer. I would work as a PA on weekends. I was totally focused on it. And then I graduated. I didn't have a job like in the film business when I graduated. So I moved to Venice Beach. My roommate and I split a one-bedroom apartment right off the boardwalk on 19th Avenue. It was $600 a month, $300 a month each. And we could, some months we could barely make the rent. And I worked as a delivery driver, delivering travel tickets around. And if I had to deliver travel tickets to a production company, I would try and pitch them, you know, I'd hand them my resume. And then somehow I got hired on a movie as a production assistant working. I worked 6 days a week, 12 hours a day for $225 a week.
Wow. Do you remember the movie?
Yeah, it was a bad gangster movie called Vern Miller with Scott Glenn. And I don't know whatever happened to it, but then they took me on to location with them. I became Scott Glenn's driver and a PA, and I got bumped. I drove a giant prop truck all the way across the country by myself to Birmingham, Alabama, which was our location, and spent 3 months there working like 100 hours a week and drove Scott to and from set every day. And that I got bumped up to $300 a week and then just kept working in the film business. And you know, I really liked commercials because they were short. Like what happens in movies is you go on location for months at a time and your work, it's like being in the circus, right? So everything else in your life, like having a relationship, reading, staying in shape, all those things that not happening. Right. And so I realized like, you know, quality of life is important to me and it's really hard to hang on to that when you're working in movies. So I tried everything, music videos, TV movies, you know, commercials, rock videos. I mean, the whole thing. And I like commercials. I like being part of the marketing kind of process. The projects were short. So I really focused on that. And I became a producer through some lucky circumstances when I was 25 years old, working for a really top comedy director named Mark Story. And he's an amazing guy. And we shot, I mean, I worked all over the world, crazy, you know, from late 80s to, you know, mid to late 90s. It was so busy. And
doing commercials.
But I was always interested in technology, was always interesting to me. My dad is a scientist. My brother is a software engineer. And so I had my own production company after that, making a lot of sports films. And that closed in 2003. We had a rough year. There was a little mini recession. I probably hadn't managed the money as well as I could have. We owed a lot of money. We closed our doors. I had to pay off a ton of money. And I could see like 2004, I could see the world was starting to change. You know, like that was in the era of MySpace, but you could see social media. There was something going on. People were blogging. Advertising was starting to change, right? You know, newspaper subscriptions were declining, you know, album CD sales were declining. iTunes was taking off. The iPod was happening. And I just could kind of look into my crystal ball. I could see there were dark clouds on the horizon for traditional media. And I realized I needed to build kind of a lifeboat out of that for myself. So I was still making television commercials. I took a couple of my directors to a friend's company so I could, I just managed a couple of directors. I didn't have to run a business. And I realized I could do that in like 4 or 5 hours a day. I didn't need the whole day. And so I figured out I needed to do something on my own the rest of the day. So I built my own running event, which would be like, I was giving myself like a PhD in kind of new marketing and media on my own, reading blogs, going to conferences, but I needed my own like doctoral thesis. So I started a running event in Santa Monica called the Santa Monica Classic. And I was an entrepreneur. I was the head of marketing for it. I would create content for it. I had been to many, many running events as a participant. I'd never managed one, but I figure, hey, I know how to produce things. It's production, right? And a lot of that was right. There were certain things that weren't, like one time we mismarked the turnaround on the 5K and turned it into a 7K, and people were just so bummed. I had to get up
My
there.
Time.
You know, like, what are you doing to me? And I had to get up there on stage at the awards ceremony, and I announced, if anybody was unhappy, it's my fault, and I'll give you a full refund.
Oh,
and
wow.
But that attracted Nike to the event, and Whole Foods, and JetBlue, and Red Bull. And I ended up working very closely with Red Bull and Nike in particular. They became sponsors. My event became like an attraction device for big brands and allowed me to do multi-channel marketing campaigns for the brand. I became fascinated with the bigger idea of marketing as opposed to I'd just been a producer. And I think as a function of my age, turning 40 around then, I kind of wanted to see the bigger world. And I really became fascinated with this idea of using my work and my marketing projects to affect positive change in the community. I had always been interested in nonprofits. I'd been on the board of Heal the Bay for a long time. I've always been an environmentalist, but I really wanted to use my work to kind of do good in society. And that really became a theme that I still work with today. And those were all things that I was exploring. My running event benefited Heal the Bay. I was starting to explore those things at that time.
Curious about that, because there's, it's in Los Angeles, around the world now, you can get involved in entertainment. Everybody's creating content. And here you are as a young guy, your first movie, then you get this gig doing commercials and producing, directing,
yeah,
all that world. Was there a conflict with you with the types of commercials that you were producing, that you were sharing? Because you said off the top, it's marketing, it's content to influence the community. And was all of your content influencing the community? If not, how did you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in my prior life as a producer of TV commercials, you're, you know, in those days, pre-internet, the only way a brand had to contact its customers was like ads, advertising. So the advertising agency was in charge of like 90% of the marketing for a brand. And as the producers of commercials, I was at, you know, on the tip of the spear for the biggest, sort of most high profile, expensive kind of marketing they were doing, which were ads. And I was part of the marketing arm for, I mean, McDonald's, Pepsi, Coke. I even did a cigarette commercial one time for a Japanese cigarette brand, which now I just cringe when I look back at that, right? And I remember we were all conflicted about that cigarette job, and the director ended up donating his director's fee to like the American Cancer Society.
Wow.
I remember, and we were all conflicted about it. And looking back, I now I'm so into food, and I go to farmers markets, and like the idea that I was working on some, you know, Big Mac, whatever, Burger King, it makes me crazy. And part of the reason I left that business and was because I had a crisis of purpose, and it just didn't sit right with me that I was trying to sell people things they didn't need.
So what do you tell millennials now? Because the whole thought around that generation, right, or even your kids, their generation, is they want to do things that have a really cool purpose around them. But you got to get in, right, especially in the entertainment industry. So cutthroat. My only way in, if it's doing cigarette commercials or if it's doing Big Mac commercials, whatever, I got to start making contacts. And that is a school of thought. Curious what your advice is to young people now who are trying to break into the industry like you did.
Right. Well, I mean, I think there are a few things that I tell young people. Like, first of all, I think having a purpose behind your work is important and fantastic. Number one. Number two, you need a craft, right? And it's important to work your ass off and get good at something, whatever that is, right? And like, you know, my craft is storytelling and marketing, right? Like, I'm good at that. I spent decades working on that. And I think now people change jobs really often. That's, you know, you kind of do your tour of duty for a couple of years and move on. And sometimes that prevents you from really putting your time in, putting in your 10,000 hours. I think that's really important. The other thing I tell kids is it is important to learn how to do your own thing. And with, you know, the digital world now, you can build up your own website, your own e-commerce thing, whatever. You can do all that on your own between you know, 7 a.m. and midnight every night. You can do those things. You know, you can start writing and have a blog. And I think those are important things to learn too. I think like entrepreneurship, I think should be a class taught in high school. Everyone should understand at some level entrepreneurship, because it's a really important thing. Even if you are not, you work for a big company that is run by an entrepreneur, you should still understand it.
We're going to get to the transition in your career in a minute, but you're a crazy traveler. I mean, you inspire me with your trips. So you're in your mid, late 20s, now early 30s. You're taking these trips around the world. Were they influencing you, and were they a tug or a nudge on you to say, no, I got to continue to influence the world because I'm still seeing this big world. And yes, on a set, I am laser focused and nothing else in the world matters. But when I get out and I go to Rwanda, or I go somewhere exploring in Europe or backpacking, wherever, did that have a major influence on you? And if so, do you remember an anecdote from some of your travels?
Yeah. I mean, I love traveling from an early age. You know, like we lived in different countries when my dad was teaching. And in high school, we moved to France because we're deeply into skiing. So in high school, my dad had a sabbatical year. My brother, my dad and I, my junior year of high school, my brother was a freshman. I had had 2.5 years of high school French. We moved to Chamonix, France in the Alps and lived in a 174-year-old farmhouse. And like the refrigerator, I'll never forget, was a room with a dirt floor and giant 2-foot-thick stone walls. And it kept the milk at the perfect temperature all the way until the spring thaw in like mid-April. It was amazing. And we just went right into the French school there. And that was a defining experience for me because like you don't really speak the language. There are no other Americans at the school. There's one kid at the school who had an American dad who knew how to speak English, one kid out of like 500. And, you know, I remember got introduced to my first class. They're like, class, this is Peter Abraham from California. They're like, no way. And I remember it was French class and they were talking about the themes of Molière in French. I'm like, oh my God, this is so above my head right now. But you just dive in and you learn. And of course there, you know, Chamonix is the global epicenter of mountain culture. It's where mountain culture was literally born in the 18th century. The world's first guides lived there. So a bunch of my friends' parents were mountain guides, their grandparents, their great grandparents were mountain guides. Like, and so my brother and I were really good skiers. Like we could go ski with the best kids. So they loved that. So we made all kinds of friends through skiing. You'd bring your skis every day to school and you just ski after school, right? You just put your skis in the ski room and your boots and you get on the bus and go, you know, it was, so that was a transformational travel experience for me because it taught me that I could parachute into any culture and figure it out. And so it was very empowering.
When you went to Rwanda and I went to Rwanda,
yeah,
and we both found our own share of trouble there.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite stories. And I'd love if you can share it. And the question from me is, because I've heard this story before, and the only rule I have in this podcast is to ask a question I don't know the answer to.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to give the background on your trip there. But I want to know what it felt like inside when all of a sudden you didn't know if you were going to be able to cross a border or not.
Yeah. So on our honeymoon, my wife, we decided to take 6 weeks and travel around the world for a honeymoon. My wife and I were both freelance producers at that time. You could kind of just say, hey, I'm taking 6 weeks off. I'll talk to you when I get back. This is pre-cell phones, really, right? Right. You weren't like checking email every morning. Like you were off the grid. And she said, you know, I really want to go. There's two places I really want to go. I want to go to Africa and I want to go to Prague. I'll let you plan it from there. So I built a 6-week trip that was 3 weeks in Africa, 3 weeks in Europe. In Africa, we went to Tanzania and Kenya, and we left a lot of room unscheduled. Like I like to plan like the first half of a trip to a foreign country and then like leave it wide open to people you'd meet and right?
Right.
That's part of the adventure and fun of it. Anyway, we get to Rwanda, and this is in the fall of 93, just before things really got nasty. So there was a lot of tension between the Hutu and the Tutsi. We just flew in and rented a Suzuki Samurai and just took off driving across the country to go find the guerrillas. Right. We had no like tour guide or like it's Kelly and Peter in the car. And like, we took a wrong turn and drove into Uganda to a Hutu refugee camp of 30,000 people. It was like the size of Tijuana or something. It was giant. Oops, wrong turn, back into Rwanda. Saw the guerrillas for 2 days, which was staggering. It was like the wildlife highlight of a lifetime. And on the way back, we're driving across the country, and it's, and Rwanda is very interesting. It's very small, right? So from one side to the other is maybe a 5 or 6 hour drive. It's like maybe the size of Southern California, not even. Super mountainous, super green, lush. And the roads are in like perfect condition because they were built by the Belgians, right? So it's very odd in such a poor country, but the roads are like perfectly smooth, but there are no cars because nobody can afford a car. And we're driving back. We're about halfway across, 2.5 hours from Kigali, where we're going to turn the rental car in. And the next day we got on a flight and fly to Paris. And you could just feel there was some weird energy going on. Like people were looking at us from the side of the road. Like you're like, God, that's, why are they kind of staring us down? Like something was going on. And as we, and then, you know, we got, there were some checkpoints manned by like 14-year-olds with AK-47s where they would make you stop, kind of look in the car and then let you go. And it was just like, something was going on. Like you just feel the negative energy. You could feel the tension. And I think in hindsight, now we know what was going on. There was this tension between the Hutu and the Tutsi. At the time, I barely even knew the difference between a Hutu and a Tutsi when I, at that point. And we're driving up this hill and this guy waves at us. And he goes, no, don't go, stop. And I just kept driving like, what's he talking about? Right? Come on. And we drive around this corner and like a couple of hundred yards up ahead, I see like 5,000 people on this hillside across the road. There are trucks blocking the road. I'm like, what's going on? Let's check it out.
Of course.
You're a total idiot, right? And I drive right up to the crowd. And like, I'm like 50 feet from this massive demonstration. And all of a sudden from the crowd, like 200 16-year-old kids with sticks and clubs start running at the car. I'm like, and I look around, I'm like, yeah, they're running at us, not like running by. They're like, they're coming for me. So I put the car in reverse. My wife's like, hey, we better get the hell out of here. I start backing up and I pull like the Starsky and Hutch, like reverse and, you know, and my wife's like, you know, honey, most people on their honeymoon, they're on a beach in Hawaii with a Mai Tai and we're like running for our lives from an angry mob in no middle of nowhere, Africa. I'm like, wow, that was really weird. And we start driving back down the hill and we see the guy who had been waving us off and we pull over and I could speak French because I'd been to school in France. Right. So that's the second language in Rwanda. I start talking to him in French. He says, there's a way around this because there's only one road across the country. It's not like you go over to the 101 and up the 5. That's the only way to get back home. He goes, there's a dirt road that'll, I'm like, hey, I'll tell you what, if I give you 10 bucks, will you? He goes, yeah. He gets in the back of the seat and starts leading us around. And we start driving down the hill and here's three guys blocking the road with clubs and rocks. And he goes, don't stop. Just go, go. We're like, oh my God. So we gas it and they get out of the way. We come around another bend. Now there's six guys blocking the road with clubs and they're throwing rocks at our windshield. He says, don't stop. So I just gun it. I put my head down. I'm not even watching. Like, am I going to run these guys over? And they clear out the last second. Rocks are hitting the windshield. We're like, shit, this is scary. And now we're like thinking like this could be it. Like we could die today. And meanwhile, we get this guy giving us directions. It turns out he's a Hutu, but I had to ask. I didn't know he was so pissed at me that I wouldn't know the difference automatically between a Hutu and a Tutsi because right. I didn't know to look for the facial features are different. I couldn't figure it out at the time. I don't know where he's leading me. Is he taking me some, you know, okay, turn off on this dirt road. So we turn on this dirt road. We go for 45 minutes back up these mountains, dirt, wilderness, nowhere central. We're so deep, deep, deep in Africa off the grid. And sure enough, here there's like a checkpoint with like 12 angry men screaming and yelling, a giant log across the dirt road. And I look back and the guy's like sweating and freaking out. I'm like, what's wrong? He goes, I forgot my identity card. And I'm like, oh my God. And we pull up. I'm like, this is where they drag us out of the car. Right. And you know, it's over and nobody ever hears from us again. And we pull up and they're yelling and he's talking to him from the back seat. I'm like, oh my God, this just does not feel good to me. And then all of a sudden they pull the log out of the way and they wave us through. I'm like, what? Okay. And we kept going. And then like a half an hour later on the dirt road, we were back on the main paved road, like upstream from the disturbance. He says, okay, I'll get out here. I gave him some cash and we kept going. And like, that was it. And we get to Kigali, to the capital, to return our rental car to the Belgian guy. And he really dismissed it. He's like, oh yeah, they always have demonstrations there. You pussies, come on. And I was like, oh my God, dude, you have no idea. And he says, hey, by the way, you're not on that flight to Paris tomorrow, are you? And we said, yeah, we are. He goes, oh yeah, the plane broke down. It's not leaving for another week. We're like, oh, come on, please, man. Fortunately, there was another flight to Belgium that had broken down that they fixed the plane that we were able to get on that one. But that night, we're back at our hotel. There are only like two hotels in Kigali. And we met a guy, a French guy from the UN. And I'm like, what are you doing here? He goes, well, for 6 months, I've been working on a big high-level meeting between the head of the Tutsis and the head of the Hutu. And he goes, that meeting was this morning. I'm like, how did it go? He goes, horrible. He goes, everybody stormed out of the meeting angry and something really bad is going to happen. I can just feel the tension. I was like, oh my God. And then 6 months later was the massacre.
Wow.
You know, that was like November and in May was the massacre. So like we were there right before it and it was, you know, so I feel lucky to have escaped from that one.
So just a quick follow up on that, because I got a bunch more to get to, but in your eyes, there's something unique to travel, right? Whether you spoke French or English or whatever the language was, I feel like there's always this language of the world, right? Like Paulo Coelho would call it love.
Yeah.
In your travels as an adventurer, explorer, you know, obviously on your honeymoon with your wife, as well as a storyteller, have you found that there's this commonality, whether it's a silent film or one in a variety of languages, we can still get the point across?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, I've thought about it a lot because on one hand, like I've always been good at languages. I like languages, but I think language is about more than the spoken language. It's about more than understanding how to ask how much is that in that language. Language is about, it's about being empathetic, understanding the other person's point of view. It's about body language. It's about what you're wearing. It's about how you carry yourself. It's about the environment around you. There are a lot of things that go into language, right? Like sense of humor, as you know, so different in different countries. And so for me, it's about like, it's about learning about what other people are like in different places. And, you know, I've also been lucky enough to be able to work in maybe 10 different countries, and working in a country is very different than traveling for pleasure because you're just mostly with the people and it's really about what are the people like, because you're in conflict with them. Sometimes you're in an argument or you're trying to get something done as a team together. And then you really learn what the people are like. Whereas a lot of times when you're traveling and having fun, you might, you know, you're kind of, your level of engagement is kind of superficial. And it's not like, hey, we're in the ditches together trying to get something done. And so I just personally think traveling is the best place to learn so many things about people around the world. And that's why I love it. And I'm passionate about it.
So speaking of language, you know, we talked off the top of how we met. You know the language of Los Angeles as well as anybody. The first real work experience, I guess, we shared together was the LA Marathon.
Yeah.
And you came on with your good friend, my good friend, Russ Piller, and you guys take over the LA Marathon.
Yeah.
And at the time, the LA Marathon was in a cool city, but it wasn't very cool, at least. It did not have the respect in the marathon world, let alone in the sport community. And you came up with the idea of from the stadium to the sea, Dodger Stadium, which if you live in Los Angeles, and I didn't get it till I lived here, like we see LA Dodger hats all around the world, but it is a global brand.
Yeah.
To start there and finish in Santa Monica. I ran it that year. Still the only marathon I've ever ran in my entire life. But how did that creatively come about? Because here you are, you do commercials for agencies, you do commercials for brands, some you're proud of, some you're not. You make this transition, you've seen the world, you travel. Now all of a sudden you go through the recession, you come to this next phase of your career, and it's about purposeful content. And your first piece of content happened to just be the Los Angeles Marathon.
Right. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that marketing and product are now totally overlapping now, right? So like exhibit A would be Tesla, right? They just had the biggest product launch in the history of the world of any product of any country. And they don't have a chief marketing officer. They do no advertising. They do marketing, but it's non-traditional. So in our case, in the case of a marathon, your biggest piece of product is your course that you're running, right? And where are you going? Where, you know, what experience are you giving your runners? And I think, you know, I tell people that manage any kind of live event now, you're in the experience architecture business, right? And so for us, you know, I had run the LA Marathon in like 92 and it was okay. It did go up through Hollywood, which was good. It went through a bunch of nondescript areas. It just wasn't inspiring. And I can't claim sole credit for designing the stadium to the C course. There was a team of four of us managing the race. And I think all of us felt the same way that it, and we were owned by the Los Angeles Dodgers at the time. It, of course, it should start at Dodger Stadium. And yes, it should end in Santa Monica. And I had already just built my own running event in Santa Monica. So I knew my way around the city of Santa Monica, which is a tricky place to get things done. And then we thought, well, LA has all these landmarks. Why shouldn't we, you know, run people up Hollywood Boulevard, by the Disney Concert Hall downtown, through Chinatown, Sunset Strip, Rodeo Drive, Century City, and at the Santa Monica Pier. Like, it just felt inevitable for us. Now, getting that deal done was a year of work. We had to have one race on the old course while we were trying to get the new course approved, because it was four different cities, four city councils, plus through the VA, which is federal property. That's like a different country. It was so complicated to get the deal done. You know, I think they'll always have that course, and it's, you know, it's beautiful to take runners on a journey like that.
You know, what I love about your journey is you've had all these touch points, and as a creative still kind of getting going and figuring out my sea legs, I love that. The LA Marathon may not be a feature film, but it is a feature piece of content, right?
Yeah.
Your commercials may not be a feature piece of content, but they are something getting spread to the world, you know, and you're influencing people that you can't recognize because through television or another means. You also did a documentary about Wilco.
Yeah.
One of the more famous bands in the world. It was named top 25 music documentaries by not just a blog, Rolling Stone.
Yeah.
How does that come about? And what was that process like for you? Because now you're diving back into the full-on feature-length creative,
right. And
you're in it, and in a different way than that first movie set when you were driving, you know, that guy around set.
So that was that project. I had my own production company at that time, and one of my directors, who was a very talented still photographer, I was trying to get his commercial career going, Sam Jones. He came to me with the idea. He said, "I want to make a film about Wilco." He was super into music. He was a musician himself, and he said, They're about to start making a new album, and I think it's like an important time for this band, and I just want to document the making of this album. He said, "Will you help me?" I said, "Okay, if you're really passionate about it, then I'll help you, and I can see how passionate you are." So he started funding it at first. We sent a crew there, and you know, he met with the band. The band, after meeting with him a few times, went, "Okay, let's do it." And we sent him out there with a cameraman and a small crew and started shooting as they were recording their album in Chicago at their loft. We cut a little trailer and nobody would even return our calls. Like neither he nor I had a background in, you know, feature films or even feature length documentaries. We had some very experienced producers helping us, but even then, like at that time, Wilco was not what they are now. I mean, they were playing the El Rey Theater in LA at that time. It was like 1,200 people. Like, they were not, their music was very good, but they weren't yet known. So we had to look at each other and go, "Okay, are we making the film or are we not? Okay, we're committing, we're making it." And we just started funding it on our own, writing checks for it. And it was not a cheap film to make. I mean, we were shooting on black and white film stock, right? Like, now you make shoot everything on video. But in those days, this is 2001 into 2002, we're shooting on black and white film. You have to have it processed. You have to have it transferred to video. And we set out to shoot for like 6 months. It turned into 15 months along the way. They got fired from Warner Brothers, their label. They resold the album for three times the deal to another Warner Brothers label through a weird twist of fate. They fired one of the members of their band. There was a lot of conflict. And this was like 2001, 2002 is when CD sales were starting to drop and the music business started to really change, right? And they became kind of the poster children for what's wrong with the music business. They got fired from Warner Brothers, at the time the most prestigious label in music, right? Like Neil Young's label. They got fired because they didn't have a radio hit. And they were such an important and great band. And that was like, right, everything is wrong about that. And the band, they were kind of invisible. They didn't have music videos really. So we kind of helped brand the band. So once interesting things started happening to the band, then word got out. First of all, they were getting written up in the New York Times and Billboard magazine. And then people started going, "Wait, what? There's a couple of guys making a film about this whole process? No way." And then we started getting inbound calls. And then around that time we thought, "Hey, since we don't have any money for this, why don't we build a website and start just sell some t-shirts?" So we had a friend of ours, Lawrence Azarad, design the website and design some t-shirts. He's a designer. And then I thought, you know, let's just put a message board on there. This is like pre, you know, there was no Twitter, there was no Facebook, right? And their fans started coming in because their fans had nowhere to hang out together. And they had fans in Japan and Germany and Canada. And they all started hanging out. And what I realized is we built a music community before MySpace. In hindsight, it was innovative. At the time, we were just trying to sell some t-shirts. Right. And then I had a contact at Apple and I said, what could we do with you guys? And my friend was at QuickTime. He's like, okay, we love that band. And what we will do is we will host all your video. At the time, hosting video was really expensive back then. There was no YouTube, right? So we would start giving him clips. We'd give clips to Apple and they would host our media and we could embed them on our website. And so every 2 weeks we'd put 8 new like clips from the movie, things that might never end up even in the movie, but fans could actually watch the movie being made as we were shooting. And again, at that time, 2001, that was pretty radical. Like nobody was doing that. So in hindsight, it was really cool, the things we were doing. And we built, and later when the film was done, Apple invited us up and they flew us up and we screened the film for the Apple employees in their theater. And then we were, I think, the first documentary that went on the iTunes site, and it's still there. Wow. You know?
Curious about, you've always been a storyteller. You know, how do you define that? You know, how do you find that art? Because you've done it in so many different areas and so many different genres.
Well, I mean, look, of course there's so many ways to tell a story, right? Like music is a way to tell a story, right? Writing, of course, is a way to tell a story. Graphics and art are a way to tell a story, and even fine art, you know, filmmaking is a way to tell a story, right? So I really jumped in as a film producer, television commercial producer, helping to produce stories. Like, you know, through a lot of my career, I wasn't the creative driver of a story, right? I was the guy organizing the whole crew and the system and staying on budget, but it wasn't my creative vision. That came from in advertising. It was the director and the creative director at the ad agency. But I was around the creative process so much, so often, week after week, I became actually pretty good. And I am a creative person. And so now, once I moved into marketing, I think I kind of found my creative legs a little bit more as a designer and a storyteller as opposed to a producer. And I think there are a lot of common themes to good storytelling that cut across. Like, I think if you really understand the basics of storytelling, I think it allows you to work in different mediums. Like, I'm not personally a graphic designer. I can't use Photoshop, but I love working with graphic designers and I know good graphic design when I see it. Or, I'm not a great writer. I'm an okay writer, but I did start blogging at the LA Marathon, which was important for me to find my writing voice. And I do read a lot and I understand good writing when I read it. So, I developed kind of a facility with, multi-channel storytelling.
So many, storytellers, for instance, and I put myself in this category. We love our alone time, right? We love just being with a journal, for instance, or maybe just with our guitar, or maybe just as you're editing late at night. What I'm so enamored and impressed with you is that you still, to the thing you said off the top, how you describe yourself, you're still about the community through that storytelling, which I think is like hard. You know, a lot of times storytellers are loners. Like, I'm great at being alone. You know, the challenge is making sure that you continue to embed with people, and you literally do it every day. You work in a workspace. You don't have to do that. What is that like for you to go into a daily environment where you got to get creative, hone a specific craft or a specific campaign or a specific story, but you're around a bunch of other people, and how does that feed you?
Well, I mean, I work out of a shared workspace, WeWork, which I like because there's a bunch of young entrepreneurs in there and I just like the energy. It's like being on a university campus. There's a lot of optimism and positive energy and you meet a lot of interesting people. For me, you know, creative energy doesn't always come for me from being alone. Like I definitely like when I'm in the car, I don't listen to music usually. And I use that as that's very valuable thinking time for me. I think a lot of really good creative work comes from just get to work, right? Like if you're writing, just sit, get the blank page, just start writing.
Right.
Right. And I think hard work is the most underrated aspect of creativity. And so I think a lot of people think of creative people and go, yeah, Picasso just showed up and just that painting just came out in 10 minutes. And I don't think creative work is like that. I think a lot of the most what you'd say in quotes, creative people, you know, actually have incredible work ethics, and a writer will write something and he'll revise and he'll revise and he'll revise. Like I saw Malcolm Gladwell write about how every writer's first draft sucks, right? Yeah. Even his. And then, you know, you work your ass off and you revise it and you revise it and it gets better. So I think a lot of creativity is about just getting down and getting to work.
What are you most proud of? What do you look at out of the work that you've done, and maybe proud, you know, being proud isn't the right word, but something you're like, yeah, you know, that work I put into it, the energy I put into it, the creative behind it, that influenced some people. What makes you look at it and say, yeah, I get a little smile, even if it's an internal one?
You know, I mean, I think there are a few things for me along the way. I think, you know, the Wilco film, I'm very proud of that. We took incredible risks. We're way out over the deep end on that one. And financially, certainly. I think my own event, my first running event, the Santa Monica Classic, I'm really proud of how I built that out of nothing and got it going. Certainly the work we did at the LA Marathon, I was proud of that. And in you know, recently, some of the work I've been doing with Lululemon or my TED Talk, where I really put in the work and really worked hard on the theme of you know, building a community around a shared idea and creating great content for them and things that make their lives better. I'm proud of that.
You know, we have a mutual friend who's been on this podcast, Brett Hughes, and Brett has a great question that I steal every podcast, and Brett, I'm continually giving you the credit for it. But he asks people, what's your best day? You know, you think about it, whether it's as a traveler, whether it's 5 years old in this community in Berkeley, whether it's working in a shared workspace, whether it's going for a run. And you think about that. What is your best day as a creative?
And are you saying like what has been the single best day, or like what would my ideal day?
What has been? I mean, outside of getting married and having amazing kids. Okay, we'll check those off. But as a creative, I'm curious, is it your best day when you're running for your life and you're fully alive in Rwanda? Is it when you're coming up with a storyboard for, oh, let's go from the stadium to the sea? Or is it something completely different?
It would be hard for me to say that there's one thing, but I think there are certain themes that come back to me on my best days. One is like when I'm creating with a team and I feel alive and everyone's aligned and you're making something great that you know is great, right? That you know is going to have positive impact. That's great. I love the feeling that you get when you've created something like that that's positive and has done good in the community and you feel great about it after, because when you're creating those things, a lot of times it's stressful. It's not like pure joy. It's hard work. It's stress. It's, oh my God, it might be costing money. It's, oh my God, the whole thing might not happen. No, maybe nobody shows up. But I think when you're done and you can reflect back on it, I think that's really powerful as well.
I love it, because the theme that I'm hearing, you always go back to community.
Yeah.
You know, and you said you couldn't remember specific moments as at 5 years old, but you were in one of the raddest communities in the history of our planet, of the United States history.
Yeah.
I'm not a analytical psychologist or a child psychologist, but I just think that about you, because you've always been the magnet that draws people in. You always want a community. And
yeah,
anything I've ever seen you with, whether it's Blacklist LA and that run through Los Angeles,
yeah,
which I'm going to ask you about in a second, but I don't know. That to me is the theme of you.
Yeah. And I think, you know, when I was getting my TED Talk ready that I just gave, the theme that I ended up on after working very hard on it and trying to really peel the layers of the onion back was building community with shared physical activity can save the world.
Mm.
That was the theme. And I think that defines a lot of the work that I've done for the past 12 or 15 years.
I love that. Okay. So I always like the last element here. I'm going to hit you with a couple questions.
Yep.
A couple words. I'd love to know your initial reaction.
Great.
One, and it's two words, street art, Blacklist.
Okay. So that was an event that we did. I was working with Lululemon, and the idea was to, the concept originally was just, what can we do for the runners of Los Angeles? We didn't have a street art project in mind. We just went out and started meeting with all these new running clubs around LA. They're in their late 20s. They run at night. It's urban. They connect on Snapchat and Instagram. the whole point of these new running clubs like Blacklist, Republic, Electric Flight Crew, Night Terrors, they sound more like bands than running clubs. And their whole point is gathering together, is social connection. So their whole point is community contact. And once we started meeting with them, we thought, hey, we asked them, we brought them all together one night. We said, how can we help you? You know, what do you guys need in the community? They give us a bunch of ideas. We have a lot of beginning and intermediate runners. We need injury prevention help. And so we put together a bunch of workshops for them. And one of them, Blacklist, which is the biggest one, they have 16,000 followers on Instagram. Their main weekly run, they have many, but their main one is Monday night starting at 10 PM. And they get like 200-300 people out for that. Downtown LA. It's not even a running area. And, their mission is to see public art when they run, and they wanted to co-create public art. We thought, okay, we'll do that for you. And I brought in the Do Art Foundation, which is the biggest public art organization in Los Angeles. And they brought amazing artists who, you know, worked in different mediums. We had like, you know, huge painted murals, cardboard sculptures that were 12 feet high, wheat paste posters. And we co-created with Blacklist all these different art projects, and we put them in a radius of about 4 miles in downtown LA, so we could have a 4 mile running route that connected them all. And then we unveiled the art on a Monday night at one of their runs. We had 600 people show up. You were there, and we ran around and saw all this art, and had the artist was stationed at each place and came out with a bullhorn and talked to these crowds. It was almost too big. It was borderline unsafe. It was spilling into the streets. It was crazy. But the point was, we were able to bring the running community and the city of LA together with public art. And we were able to actually make the city a better place, like how the buildings looked and felt like, right? Some of these murals are permanent and will be up for years, right? And so running really can not only change people, but it can change a physical landscape.
How do you see failure?
Wow. I mean, you know, failure can be really hard. And I would say I'm one of those people who, you know, I'm in technology a lot. So I'm like, yeah, fail fast, all those kind of cliches. Same time, like, I don't think failure is a goal. Like, I don't think any of us are trying to fail. But of course, all of us are going to fail at some level, and fail a lot probably, right? And so I have learned so much from failure. And I would say certain parts of failure are like really hard. Like, I remember having to close my company and we owed all this money. Like, it took me years to get over that. The shame, the humiliation, the cost. Like, some of that stuff is really hard. Did I learn valuable lessons? Absolutely. But hard stuff. So there are many kinds of failure. You can fail in a relationship. You can fail in business. You could fail on a product. I mean, there's so many different kinds of failure. But I think if you turn it around and you're, I try to practice mindfulness now. I meditate about 5 days a week, and I try and see everything. I try and be grateful for everything, right? A friend of mine gave me this book called Gardens of Gratitude, which looks at a lot of Jewish teachings and tries to kind of connect those with the idea of gratitude, and try and be grateful for everything that happens in your life, even things that are really painful and really difficult. I think there's always some kind of a silver lining to be had. But I will say it's a constant struggle. That is not easy. Like, it sounds glib to like, yeah, you know, find something positive in every failure. That's not always easy. It can be really hard.
No doubt. How do you look at competing? Because you are in my opinion, one of the top three most competitive cities in the world, in the most competitive industry, in my opinion, in the world. How do you look at that word?
You know, I have always loved competition. Like, I love sports growing up since I was 5 years old. And so I've always loved competition and competitive sports. I think there's so much to be learned from that about yourself, about others. I personally love it. And I get that not everybody is competitive, and I get there are people that are far more competitive than I am. I wouldn't say I've defined my life, but I am naturally a competitive person, and I love competitive sports. And so I think there's a lot to be learned for it. I think competition makes you better. And I think, I don't think it has to be a win at all costs. Winning is everything. I don't think it's about that, but I think it's about measuring yourself about others. Like, sometimes you're competing against somebody who's just way better, whether it's in work or sports, and you're like, wow, the bar is really hot, set high. I got to get better. Right. And I think that's a positive thing for people.
What do you think for you, you would describe a full life as?
Wow. That's such a loaded, open question. You know, like, look, I think if, you know, I think selfishly, you know, I think in a certain way to live a full life, you have to be a little bit selfish and live for yourself and not for other people. I think that is important. At the same time, I think you need to treat others well, and you want to feel good about how you treated others and how you treated the world. And did you leave the world a better place than when you arrived? That's how I'd look at it.
That's cool, man. What makes you feel most alive? You do a lot. You've done a lot. We've touched on some big picture. We've delved into some other elements, but curious what really makes you feel alive.
I think for me, it's being outdoors. I mean, if I had to boil it down to one thing that makes me feel alive, I think it's being outdoors. And that's why I have spent a lot of my life doing that. I probably don't get to do it as much as I would like with kids, although they're graduated from high school. It's going to start changing. Like, pendulum's going to swing back my way. I'm kind of excited about that. But I think when I'm outdoors in the wilderness, whether it's surfing or hiking or running or skiing or whatever it is, that's when I feel most alive.
That's cool. And then finally, this theory where I think that we all have a flame, an internal flame. And sometimes this fire is roaring, right? And if it is, and it's this nice campfire, people are leaning in. I've always felt that way about you. Sometimes our flame is dwindling and we need a new log on the fire. We got to turn it over. We need some kindling. If you had to describe your flame, how would you do that?
You mean go further with that.
So your inner flame, right? You've got this inner flame that is either stoked, charging, and you feel people leaning in. Or it's a little lighter and you've got to keep putting logs in the fire to keep it moving. You know, you're a guy that has gone through ebbs and flows in his career, highs and lows, as you've talked about. Now, looking back and continually moving forward, have you found a consistent flame for yourself? And if so, what does it look like? Is it roaring? Is it just a steady burn? You know, how would you describe it?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question. I think there's not necessarily a correlation between external success, what people would judge as like money, house, whatever it is, and the flame burning. Like, sometimes when the flame is burning bright is when things are kind of rough, right? And sometimes when you're maybe making good money or you're doing things that people would judge as successful, the flame has kind of extinguished itself by then, but you just happen to be sort of like cashing the checks at that point. So I don't think those things are correlated. For me, I like to be fully engaged and I would say making things. Like, I need to be, one of the things I've learned is I need to be close to the making process, you know, whether it's, you know, making stories, businesses, right? And so when I'm fully engaged in making something that is enjoyable to me, that's when my flame is really burning bright. And that's not always visible to the people around me necessarily. They might be able to intuit it based on my mood or my attitude. But that might be at a point when a business is making no money or losing money, or you're having a hard, it's struggling because you're not there yet. But when you're engaged and making things, that for me is, that's when the flame's burning.
That's awesome, man. This has been an incredible conversation. Long time coming. I really appreciate it, man. I've looked up to you for a long time and we've had this kinship and this, you know, I think we're kind of kindred spirits in a way. So thanks for coming into the lab a little bit and hopping on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
You got it, man. What a cool conversation, huh, with Peter Abraham. Thanks for listening in. What I took away from that was this guy's entire life has been around community. I mean, without even realizing probably at times, I mean, he's always pulled community together. You know, when he was a kid, he was in Berkeley with his dad and, you know, the whole 60s and 70s movement. And then as you look at his life, he's always been around that. So much so you think of the LA Marathon. Now, that's the biggest community in sports is running. So to me, he's got this amazing draw to him as a storyteller, as an adventurer, of course, as an entrepreneur. But really, he's kind of that magnet, that flame that is always drawing people together, both creatively, whether it's on screen, whether it's in the written word, or whether it's literally through physical activity. So as always, we like to end with a challenge on this podcast. And I think it's to explore your community. You know, what is your community like? Are you bringing community together? Do you enjoy being around community? Can you assess your community? And kind of like my dad has always said, you are the company that you keep. So for Peter Abraham, we appreciate it. Also really appreciate you listening to the Life Without Limits podcast. I'm really jacked about that. We just found out we are on Overcast as well. You can check us out on Blog Talk Radio. And of course, subscribe on iTunes, and any reviews or shares has been huge. And really the love that we've gotten on this has been massive. So thank you so much for listening in. That was Peter Abraham, And as we like to leave on this podcast, the only limits that we have in life are the ones we set ourselves. Peace.